This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
People need to feel listened to and respected. You know, it's almost like what you want to do is you want to understand them before you try to get them to understand you. That's what, to me, what common ground means, right? And that's what the making the emotional connection is. The good news about this is we all know how to do this.
Has this ever happened to you? You're talking with a friend or family member, and as the topic moves to politics, things start to get a little heated. You make what you think are excellent points based on data, logic, and what you fervently believe to be the absolute truth. Yet, when the debate concludes, somehow, neither of you has budged an inch, and no one leaves any wiser. Perhaps this is why we're instructed to never discuss politics in polite company. This week on Sea Change Radio, we're talking about bridging the divide with James Hogan, an author and the co-founder of DeSmog Blog. Hopefully, the next time the subject of impeachment or the Democratic nominee of your choice arises, the debate can be spirited, productive, and maybe even polite. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by James Hogan. He is an author and a public relations consultant, and he's also the co-founder of the DeSmog blog. Jim, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's terrific to have you. I've been a longtime fan of DeSmog blog. Why don't you explain what that is? And then I want to dive into your last book, which is coming out in its second edition. It's called I'm Right and You're an Idiot. So what is the DeSmog blog?
Well, I started DeSmog Blog in 2005 after reading a book by Ross Geltzman from Boston, and he wrote a book called Boiling Point that looked at kind of organized misinformation campaigns that were designed to create confusion about climate science. And I took a look at it, and I had, you know, I'd been in the PR business for many, many years, 30 plus years, and I'd always felt that the kind of public relations that people should practice and that I tried to practice was that you try to be straight with people, and that when people start to kind of mess with the facts too much, you end up in conversations that are usually not worth people's time. And so I tend to get angry if people purposely misleading about a particular kind of public debate. And I remember watching climate scientists in the midst of basically losing debates to some of these political guys from one in particular, a guy named Mark Morano. And he was on BBC in this debate with this real climate scientist. And it basically, the climate scientist was losing the debate, even though he had all the science on his side. And I just thought it's kind of outrageous. So I stepped into it with DeSmog Blog, thinking that that it was kind of a battle against misinformation. But one of the things that I learned over the years, as DeSmog Blog became really popular, and I wrote a book about it called Climate Cover-Up, The Crusade to Deny Global Warming. But one of the things I learned is that propaganda is not just about misinformation. In fact, it's mainly not about misinformation. That's one of the kind of, it's a little bit of the smoke in the world of propaganda. But the real fire and the real destructive part of propaganda is tribalizing people. So if I can convince you that this isn't something that people like us believe, if you believe this, you can't be one of us, you must be one of them, then that is a propaganda victory. So that it's propaganda does it tribalizes. Certainly it misinforms, it spreads false ideas, but it also attacks people's sense of the collective. You know, it tries to undermine our confidence in in public discourse, in objectivity itself. You know, it basically is making an argument, whether it says it or not. It's making an argument that everybody's biased. Everybody's just in it for themselves. You can't really trust anything anybody says. And so it's almost trying to stir up despair. And so what I realized was that propaganda is far more insidious and far more destructive. And then I started to do some interviews more recently for this book. I interviewed a woman named Carol Tavris, who wrote a best-selling book called Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. And it's basically a book about how we don't like to admit we're wrong. We don't like to admit if we've made a stupid mistake or we've done something immoral, because we see ourselves as smart, good people. And so if we do something really terrible, really stupid, we tend to not want to admit it, and we self-justify. And what she says is that this mechanism that we all have basically means that people can be both producing and consuming false information, like propaganda, unknowingly. And so it's actually far worse than just misinformation, with these aspects of propaganda that I've learned about over the past decade, I think make it something we should all be concerned about when we hear about guys like Steve Bannon or Cambridge Analytica or these other sorts of efforts to pull one over on people.
So what are the best ways to engage with somebody who really looks at things from a completely different viewpoint than you when it comes to climate change, for example? If you're at a family dinner and your long-lost cousin is saying, yeah, well, I wouldn't believe that science about climate because, you know, climate scientists are getting paid to give data that's misleading and they all just want to take away our cars. That person is pretty set in their belief. What is the best way to engage with that person? Or is it worth it?
You know, I got to tell you, in sort of, this isn't exactly my area. You know, I think there's a group called Smart Politics that's just come up over the last year or so, or at least I've just become aware of it, that they specifically coach people on how to do that. And it's, there's a process that they take people through that I'm not qualified to go through that is far better than anything that I'd ever thought about. But anyone who gets a chance to just, you know, Google Smart Politics and take a look at the work they do. But let me tell you, just generally, I number one, I think it's critically important that people don't, you know, sort of drive those types of conversations either into silence or into, you know, red hot anger, which often happens. So people, you know, over Thanksgiving or Christmas or whatever, you know, your grumpy uncle starts this conversation with you and, you know, before you know it, it's just heading into deep unreasonableness. And so I think part of what the problem is that we tend to be unaware of the emotional triggers that we have ourselves and other people do. And so we trigger ourselves with anger or fury at someone not listening to facts. But we also do the same to them. That's what I meant about this sort of tribalizing problem. If people think that this isn't something people like us believe, you're actually having a different conversation than you think. People become, one of the guys I interviewed from my book is a guy named Jonathan Haidt, and he said, that human beings are evolutionary. It's like an evolutionary design to join in teams and to stand up against other teams. And then he said to be blinded to the truth. What basically ends up happening is that as soon as you start to engage in the psychology of teams, open-minded thinking shuts down. So in a way, what you said is right, that you have to be you don't want to have that conversation, but that doesn't mean that you don't want to have the conversation.
And building on that, Jonathan Haidt also said, our moral beliefs bind us and blind us. So there's, yep. I guess with the climate change issue, is somebody who doesn't believe in climate science, that person is blinded by propaganda or whatever is driving them to be willfully ignorant on the subject? And how do you find that moral belief system to bind the two of you to say, we agree that it's getting hotter, or it's almost like having a theological discussion, isn't it?
Well, I think part of it is the order of things, that you start with trying to find some common ground. And I think part of that is in asking questions and listening, and asking the kinds of questions that aren't, that don't have a point on them, right? You're trying to open up the conversation.
Right. When you're canvassing, you're supposed to ask, what are the issues you're most passionate about, to somebody, before you just say, this is why I'm for gun control or whatever.
That's right. And so, and I think that the emotional connection is everything. That you, it's not just the factual content, because when you're dealing with the psychology of teams, a lot of it is emotional. And people have been driven into fear and anger and close-mindedness in a lot of the time by propaganda campaigns. And so you can't just expect to go in and clear it all up with your superior knowledge of whatever. So I think that trying to figure out a way that you can connect with people before you, and I'm sure you've done this. I've done it with people who are, like, surprisingly, like a friend of mine, it turned out, was sort of, you know, didn't think climate change was as big a problem as I thought it was, and voted for Stephen Harper, the climate change denying prime minister we had here a while back in Canada. And so I was quite surprised that this guy was like this. But, you know, in some of our conversations, we basically were able to move it forward, even though he thought he knew so much more about all this than I ever did. And it was like a, it was a very, you know, but part of it was just people need to feel listened to and respected. You know, it's almost like what you want to do is you want to understand them before you try to get them to understand you. That's what, to me, what common ground means, right? And that's what the making the emotional connection is. The good news about this is we all know how to do this. I mean, some of us may be really good at it, and some of us may need to get better at it. But, I mean, people know what I'm talking about, you know.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to James Hogan. He's an author and also the co-founder of the website DeSmog Blog. So, Jim, let's turn to people on the left, progressive-minded individuals who are disagreeing over an issue. We're in the debate season right now for the U.S. presidency for the Democratic primary, and a lot of people are having these discussions trying to decide between these 23 candidates. So let's say you are supporting Julian Castro and I'm supporting John Hickenlooper or whatever, or you're undecided and I'm a big John Hickenlooper fan. What is a good way to kind of get you on board with John Hickenlooper?
Yeah, I guess I'm of the school that I don't think most people are sitting around waiting for me to tell them what to think. And so if somebody is kind of resisting, I think the first thing I do is try to create common ground in whatever way.
What's a good way to do that?
It's asking questions, asking open-ended questions, kind of non-judgmental, like, why, it, you know, not questions like, you know, why would you believe something that stupid, right? Or you don't want, you know, even if you're just subtly implying that to people, what the kind of questions are basically, tell me more.
And I've heard also one kind of yardstick is try to find five areas of common ground.
Yeah.
And it may not even be related at all to what you're talking about, but this is with a stranger, right?
Yeah. So one of the things that people that I interviewed for the book talked about was this difference between these two parts of your brain, the amygdala, which is that's where the psychology of teams and the anger lives, and then the frontal cortex, which is where thoughtfulness is. So for a whole bunch of reasons, the amount of time we have, how angry we are at the other side or people who disagree, you know, that this whole amygdala is like really highly heightened in highly polarized public discourse. That's the way it is right now. And so when you're talking to people, you need to be aware of the kind of emotional to and fro of this and try to kind of create space where people can get back into the part of their brain that is more kind of thoughtful. And so you really have to be super careful not to be pushing those emotional buttons for yourself or for them, right? So part of it is a kind of just awareness of the connection that you have with the person and the tone that you use. I mean, I had a very, very good friend of mine who I, you know, deeply admire. Like we got into a conversation a few weeks back and it just kind of went off the rails, you know, and I didn't think I was doing much. My wife didn't agree with me afterwards. We had a talk about it. And I think that there's kind of very subtle things that we do that we're not aware that we're doing that push people's buttons. And I think just it's not a sort of there isn't a kind of a I don't think a easy, quick answer to how you do this. I think it's something that takes practice, that people need to be just more aware of the kind of emotional landscape and how you're moving in it with that person. And we all know people. I used to have a VP who worked for my PR firm who was just a master at it. I mean, she could come in and give you the worst news and you'd still love her, you know. I mean, she just had this kind of sense of people. And I think most of us don't have that kind of gift, and we have to work at it. And I think just because somebody's generally on the same side as you doesn't mean you can't fall into this kind of, you know, unyielding one-sidedness.
Yeah, so you've almost kind of lost your moral high ground or any kind of advantage to sway that person if you're passionate about it and you start talking too much. I mean, that's one of the problems I have. I find myself passionate about something and the other person may not have as much passion about it or much information about it. And I just start telling them everything I know about it. And that can turn people off. They can glaze over. Not everybody is like, oh yeah, yeah. But when you're taught to sell something, you're supposed to get positive responses from that person all the time. You know, when you're selling stocks or bonds, you're like, you like tax-free income, right? And that person goes, yes. And you're trying to have that kind of a repartee with somebody where they're giving you affirmative feedback consistently. But we miss that when we're debating an issue too often, don't you think?
Yeah, I agree. And I see, I think that the problem with polarization, well, like a highly polarized public space, one of the problems with that is that advocacy, or as you said, selling ideas, or you know, debate, it almost just by its very nature, the way it works is triggering. So it just makes it everything more polarized. Whereas dialogue, where you basically enter into the conversation with a lot of listening, and with the sort of sense that not that you have something to explain to someone and how do you do that, but more that both of you may have a piece to the puzzle and what might that look like, right? So you know what I mean? And people can feel that. People know whether or not you even care that they're sitting across from you, right? They feel that. And they certainly know whether or not you respect them. They know whether or not you're hearing them. So, you know, at the risk of being repetitive, that kind of stuff is important because when everything is polarized, what you're really trying to do is diffuse the polarization to create the space for the conversation because the space doesn't even actually exist. So, you know what I mean? Like there's when everything is highly polarized and there's very high levels of mistrust and the other side thinks you're despicable maybe, or stupid or an idiot about something, there's no space for the conversation. So part of the job has to be to create the space.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to James Hogan. He is the author of I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. I'd like to kind of find the confluence of the propaganda problem that you refer to with tribalism. I don't think it's as pronounced in your country of Canada as it is in the U.S. right now, but would Richard Nixon have been impeached if there were a Fox News back in the mid-70s? How much of what we're seeing today is a result of propaganda?
Yeah, no, I do think that this is the product of propaganda. And again, it's not just propaganda to say that, you know, climate change is a hoax by the Chinese, but it's more just remember whose side you're on and remember everybody's biased. And so that's not a legitimate point of view. That's just liberals.
So it's red team versus blue team, and it doesn't matter what the issue is. I think that's kind of what Donald Trump was referring to when he said, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and they'd still vote for me. It's because they're on the red team. And you've seen this president kind of, by all objectivity, is lying consistently, has laid out some very destructive policies, but still his base, 90% approval rating amongst Republicans. That's their guy. They have unwavering belief in this, in their team.
Yes. And I think the way that this cultural cognition works, there's been great work done across the United States, particularly at Yale by Dan Kahan on cultural cognition, which is basically this thing where it's the way if evidence comes along that contradicts the beliefs of my community, my team, I don't change the beliefs, I change the evidence. And so you protect the integrity of and the values that as you perceive them of your group by through motivated reasoning and just changing ignoring information that undermines your beliefs and looking for information that reinforces them. And so these are very sort of powerful psychological and sociological forces, like hunger and thirst. So these are somebody who's under the grip of this is it's not like they're just stupid, right? A lot of people who have these kinds of false beliefs are quite smart and just maybe even smarter than you. So it's not about intelligence. It's not about being misinformed. It's about the tribalism, right? And once you get that, then these kinds of conversations all become much more difficult. And so you basically have to have the idea in mind that, is the space here? How do I create the space? And one of the ways of doing that is to not behave the way that the narrative of the other side expects you to behave.
For example?
Well, it's just like, do you look like a liberal with your hair on fire? Are you, going around like screaming day and night about Donald Trump, right? So,
yeah, it confirms their bias.
Yeah, so it's always better for if you want to change the beliefs of the other team to get their team to help you do it. And so,
but they become almost apostates in the Republican Party. So somebody like Bill Kristol, who was a huge cheerleader for the Iraq War and loved Reagan and Bush, but now Trump is one step too far and he's kind of come over to the other side. But I think he's confirming what Democrats want to hear, but I don't think he's necessarily changing hearts and minds on the red team. Do you?
I think some of them. I mean, I think David Brooks, for example, is another
Right.
Those guys have big followings.
Sure.
Right? So I think that trying to sort of navigate it that way and not – see, one of the things I've seen in the environmental community over the years is that you start to assume that everybody who disagrees with you is evil. Or is like, trying to obstruct science. And that's not, even with climate change, that's not true. I mean, there are a lot of people who disagree with you on whatever, like a carbon tax or that actually just legitimately disagree. And so treating everyone like they're on that other team and behaving in a way that they expect you to behave is a downside, you know, because if the problem is what I said it was, which is it's not the misinformation, it's the tribalizing. So the question always is there some way to diffuse this? Is there some way to at least not trigger it?
And you say hold your own beliefs lightly, which is the tricky thing, right?
Yeah, I think it's that was something Carol Tavares said. And, you know, that's a bit of a, like, I think that you, what it is that, It's like another person said something like, you too could unknowingly be under the influence of bias, right? So we could all be biased. We can all be wrong.
Oh, we absolutely right? are all biased. And it's just a question of admitting to that as a kind of a starting point for a discussion. It's like, sure, I'm biased because I'm a white male. So I'm coming at this from a perspective, whether I like it or not. It's hard for me. I can't put myself in someone else's shoes. I can to some degree, but I can't actually be in that person's shoes.
Yeah, and I think having that kind of an attitude in the conversation and realizing that the first thing that you're trying to do is not convince the other person that you're right and they're wrong, because that does, you know, they may look at that and think you're, you know, trying to convince them that, you know, you're right and they're an idiot, right? So that's not the first thing you do. The first thing you do is, as we said earlier, try to find, open up the space. How do you do that? And a lot of the time, it is through making sure that people can see themselves in this. You know, there's more and more people on the right concerned about climate change because they're concerned about forest fires, or they're concerned about flooding or hurricanes, or, you know, big weather events are having a big impact around the world with climate change denial. And so I think being thoughtful about that and in that conversation, not to the point, like I do think that democracies need people who feel strongly about things, and we should encourage, you know, guys like Bill McKibben who've devoted their lives to speaking up and speaking strongly. Thank God for Bill McKibben. So I'm not an advocate of holding your beliefs lightly in that way, but I'm just, you know, we always have to just be, you know, strive to be reasonable. And but at the same time, we want advocates. But advocacy can be a trap when we feel that we're constantly in a fight between David and Goliath.
Well, it's a terrific book, and I enjoyed the conversation tremendously. The book is I'm Right and You're an Idiot. Jim Hogan, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Hey, well, thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Wolf Peck and War. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.